We're talking about so-called fertility fraud here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So we're tracing the history of some physicians who had used their own sperm for artificial insemination in IVF procedures, in vitro fertilization, creating embryos from mixing eggs and sperm in lab dishes. And fast forward to today, what states are doing about this decades later is that at-home DNA tests are exposing more and more biological fathers who are the fertility donors themselves. So did you get pregnant through IVF? Did you choose an anonymous donor, or do your children know about the biological father? What went into that decision? We're at 800-642-1234. Jody Madeira is a law professor and co-director of the Center for Law, Society, and Culture at the Maurer School of Law at Indiana University. And her most recent book is called Taking Baby Steps, How Patients and Fertility Clinics Collaborate in Conception. Jody, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so very much. Thanks for having me.
So before we look at these cases, explain for us what IVF is and what happens in fertility clinics here.
So what IVF is it basically takes, you know, the egg of a woman, a younger woman, usually, and depending on the clinic in particular, you take this egg, make sure it's mature, you put it into a petri dish in one of several mediums, and you add the sperm from either a donor, male, or the intended father.
Okay. And so now, as we have been doing this for decades, apparently it was 1978 when the first IVF embryo was worked out. Is that right?
Yes. And so a lot of these fertility fraud cases have happened, actually, almost all of them with intrauterine insemination.
So this Texas woman, Eve Wiley, took an at-home DNA test a few years ago. She was conceived through IVF, but when she took the test, she found out that her biological father was her mother's fertility doctor. Tell us more about Eve's story and how that played out.
Yes. So Eve's story is very unique because her mother is the only one. Her mother is Margot Williams, and Margot's the only woman who was ever the victim of fertility fraud who has her medical records. And so this was on a 2020 episode back in May, and it was amazing to hear that for some reason, Margot kept her records. And when you look at the records, it says donor 106 from California Cryobank. Now, what has happened is that Eve Wiley's doctor, Dr. Kim McMorris, who works in Nacogdoches, Texas, has said that donor 106 just wasn't doing what it needed to do. He thawed the sperm. It didn't look good. And so this was unusable. And so then he reached out. Somehow he had frozen sperm, he claims, in Galveston, Texas, or otherwise procured a sample of sperm from himself. It's extremely unlikely it would have been frozen at that time because people are just starting to freeze sperm. The first commercial sperm banks are starting. And med sperm is, quite frankly, a dime a dozen at that point because med students are frequent donators. But in any fashion, he uses his own sperm to help conceive Eve. And then years later, decades later, Eve takes a 23andMe test and learns that, in fact, donor 106 is not her father, but Kim McMorris. But in that the decades, you know, since her conception, Eve grew up. And when she found out she was donor conceived, she was about 16. When she was 18, she contacted California Cryobank and they matched her up to donor 106, who is a man named Steve. And she reached out to Steve and the two formed this very loving relationship that felt very much like a sort of nascent father-daughter relationship. Eve's biological, Eve's psychological father had died, the man she believed to be her her natural father. And so she was very happy that Steve was in her life. But then when she took a 23andMe test, she found out that she was actually not matched to Steve. Steve appeared nowhere in the list of family members or relatives that show up. So when you take a genetic test, you kind of get this genetic Facebook page that appears. And you're linked to all the relatives that have also taken that same test. And Steve did not appear anywhere there. Instead, who appeared were relatives of Kim McMorris. And so she found that very disturbing.
We're talking with Jody Madeira. She's a law professor at Indiana University, and we're looking at these cases involving IVF. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you conceived through IVF? Do you have the choice to find out your biological father, and what went into that decision? How did you feel about it? What questions do you have about how the medical community handles the IVF process today and how the courts are involved? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jody, how common is Eve's story? How many cases are out there like this?
I would say we're approaching 30 around the world. And it started basically in 1995, where we had a doctor named Cecil Jacobson, who seemed sort of very far out on the limb at the time. He both, you know, created fake pregnancies in women through hormonal treatments, and also used his own sperm to help them conceive. That was against the standard of care then. And then when these cases started coming out from the 1970s and 1980s, then it really has gained a lot of attention since then. But we found out, too, that there were people in the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s who were also conceived through fertility fraud. They're just not so much in the public view.
Let's take a call now. Ed is joining us from West Allis. Hi, Ed.
Morning.
Good morning.
Professor, do these children that were conceived through in vitro fertilization with a doctor have any right to get any damages in any type of civil lawsuit from either the clinic or from the doctor?
Ed, that's a great question, because in the Eve Wiley story in Texas, it led to a new law, Jody.
Yeah, so I would think that that's an excellent question, and it depends on the state in which people are living. So, for example, in Indiana, where there is the law that says, basically, if a doctor does something wrong to you, and you find out years later, maybe in part because the doctor defrauded you, then you can recover. It's called the discovery rule. And you have about, you know, 3 years or so from the time you discover the fraud to when you can file suit. In our Indiana law that we passed last year, we explicitly give the doctor conceived children a right to recover. And but in states like Texas, for example, they have a law that says you have a 10-year period to bring all claims related to medical malpractice. And so in that state, you have to catch it within 10 years, which is pretty unlikely unless you just conceived, you know, and your child is fairly young. So it largely depends on state law. However, there is one case which is moving forward at this time, Mortimer versus Rowlett, where this is an Idaho case. And due to the state law, they said that people can only bring medical malpractice claims if they're patients of the physician. And because the doctor conceived child there had not yet been conceived, wasn't in existence, then basically she could not be a patient of the doctor. I think that's a highly unusual result, and you would not see that very often in other states.
We're tracing the series of scandals in which fertility doctors impregnated women with their own sperm without their knowledge or consent. Indiana University law professor Jody Madeira follows these cases as they wend their way through the courts in some states. Are you a sperm donor or have a relationship with your biological children? Or maybe you'd like to, but don't. Join in with your story. Are you an OBGYN or a fertility physician? What are your thoughts on the issue of fertility fraud? 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about in vitro fertilization and the broader ethics around fertility fraud as we learn that fertility specialists decades ago secretly used their own sperm for artificial insemination. And dozens of these cases have started surfacing here in the U.S. and in other countries. Are you a sperm donor? Did you do it when you were younger for the money or later in life? Did you decide to be anonymous, or were you open to having a relationship with a biological child at some point down the line? Join in with your story at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Jody Madeira is a law professor at Indiana University. She co-directs the Center for Law, Society, and Culture, and she stays with us. Jody, you've been following a few dozen of these cases throughout the United States and the world. You look at the ethics around this as well as the law. What have you found among these cases? Are there some common threads?
Oh, yes. And so these cases come up in a very, you know, common fact pattern. So it usually happens when an adult who's in their 30s and 40s takes a direct-to-consumer genetic test, like 23andMe or Ancestry.com, and gets strange results back, only to find that she has many half-siblings, or that she might not be related to her siblings who took a test. And by the way, that, you know, 30 to 40-year age range is just the cases that have been coming out recently. There are individuals who are older, in their 50s, in their 60s, who are also discovering this. And her parents may have told her at some point that she was donor conceived. She might not know. And at some point, she contacts the half-siblings who are listed on this genetic Facebook through the genetic testing platform. And she learns that, oh, maybe their parents saw fertility treatment from the same provider. Often they have a relationship to the fertility physician's first cousin or an acknowledged child. And what usually happened as the story unravels is that the doctor and the couple agreed that the woman who was his patient would be inseminated with either sperm from the husband or a mixture of sperm from the husband and the donor, or a sample from an anonymous male donor, usually a medical resident resembling the husband. So I think that's the common fact pattern.
Oh, okay. And so then there may be an element of consent here, because in Texas, the law says, you know, without consent, this is sexual assault.
Yes. And what women do is they consent to the procedure, but the procedure is designed to be done with particular sperm, you know, and it, the woman would not have consented to that procedure had the sperm she expected, you know, not been used. And so I hate to say this, but if the doctor had told her, well, you know, the donor didn't show, maybe I'll use my own sperm, it would have been legal, but not ethical, because at least the woman would have had the opportunity to consent, you know, knowing whose sperm that was.
Let's bring in another call now. Charlie is joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
So my question is, what are the legal ramifications of these doctors? Are they going to get in trouble and go to jail, go to prison? I understand that they have maybe monetarily, they are owed money or whatever for their wrongdoings. But what are the legal ramifications for the doctors? I feel like they should go to prison. This is wrong.
Charlie, thanks so much. And as we understand here, Jody, only three states have laws against fertility fraud.
Yes. And I think, you know, other states could take a look at it as well and decide to send someone to prison. But that's a really great question. And that is, of course, what the doctor-conceived children and their patients want to know. The women feel like they've been raped. The doctor-conceived children feel like they were born from rape. Everyone feels like this is sexual assault. And what happens, though, is very, very few. In fact, only one doctor has been sent to prison, that's Cecil Jacobson. But in, I think, mostly he was imprisoned for inducing fake pregnancies for patients who traveled across state lines. So he was actually indicted and prosecuted and sentenced on the federal level for, you know, interstate travel fraud and wire fraud and charges like that. Dr. Donald Klein, or the former Dr. Donald Klein here in Indianapolis, but he has between 61 and 64 doctor-conceived children at this point. It's the largest case that we know of in America, and he has never been prosecuted for it. I think it's hard for prosecutors to get their heads around the fact that women consented to the procedure because, and therefore it's not sexual. But I think when you look at the procedure, there are several sexual elements, including that the physician himself engaged in a sex act immediately before the insemination. So Donald Klein ended up going to prison for obstruction of justice. He did not go to prison. He was eligible, but he was basically fined $500 and then sent on his merry way after he pled guilty to two counts of obstruction of justice because he had lied to the state after two of his doctor-conceived children went to the attorney general bringing a consumer fraud claim and without any provocation after receiving just notice of the claims, Klein denied it. But a genetic test later revealed that he was lying.
We're talking with Jody Madeira. She's a professor of law and co-director of the Center for Law, Society, and Culture at Indiana University. You can join in. Do you think physicians using the incorrect donor sperm or using their own sperm should be considered sexual assault? How should the law handle these cases? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jody, have you found that cases where these have come out and the physician doesn't lose their medical license, can they keep on practicing?
Oh, yes. In fact, so several doctors are sued for this and they are still practicing. So there's a number of ways of handling these cases. Sometimes people file suit and they seek to settle or they threaten to sue. And in that case, these allegations might never come to light and the doctor might never have an interruption to his practice. In other situations, like Eve Wiley's story in Texas, Kim McMorris actually is in practice with his son. And after the 2020 episode, you know, I believe there has been some action to trying to take away his medical license, but it's been difficult. The Texas Medical Board is not acting. They have not gotten back to that individual who made the complaint. And so it seems like some protectionism might be going on. And of course, I talked about Dr. Donald Klein, where it took a year to take away his medical license, but he was not practicing. So I think it just is depends case by case.
In the legal community, it seems that there's not all agreement on the Texas law that ties us to sexual assault, that Texas is going too far, that we're blurring a line between natural and assisted conception. Do you think this law in Texas will hold and should be perhaps a model for the rest of the country?
I think it will hold. And I think that what those concerns come out of is that, you know, back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, when this type of treatment was very controversial, people really wanted to separate the act of donation from the act of sex because they did not want to see a donor be looked upon as the man with whom the wife who was inseminated had an adulterous relationship. You know, so the donor is someone who waives parental rights to a future child. And it's not like having an affair with one's husband. Yet that was the claim that men would bring when their wives, when they had initially agreed to insemination, they had a child, and then years down the road, they want to divorce. You know, basically, the husband would try to pawn this child off as the product of an affair. And that couldn't hold. You know, court said donor-conceived children have the same rights to inheritance, to a paternity, as other children born within the marriage. And so I think that's an important holding. But now we're in a different position, and now we recognize, you know, that donation is increasingly common, whether it's from eggs or whether it's from sperm or indeed whether it's from embryos. And we're well accustomed to, you know, putting a distance that wasn't there before between the donor and the couple. And I think we don't have a problem with seeing the donation sexual anymore. In fact, one could argue that that's why these cases with the fertility fraud are so disturbing to begin with, because the doctor is producing the sample. You know, I won't be graphic, but he's producing the sample in proximity to the place where the patient is. And this is, he has to, because the sperm has to be viable. So, and might even be under the physiological effects of that sex act when he performs the insemination himself. And I think because these cases bring the act of donation and sex close together, that is what people find so disturbing. And that's the ick factor.
As we look at that ick factor, but how in decades past were sperm labeled and were these samples labeled? You mentioned medical records. Could we trace history that well decades ago?
I believe so. I think it was obvious that the doctor was using his own sperm because, simply put, the samples weren't being kept around long enough, most of them, for them to get mislabeled. So they were produced and used within very short periods of time. I think the potential for mislabeling actually came up when the samples were frozen, which started to happen more so around the, you know, mid-1970s and then through the 1980s. And that's where, you know, the potential for this other kind of negligence, the mislabeling of gametes, really comes up.
We're talking about IVF, in vitro fertilization, and practices of fertility physicians using their own sperm and fraudulent practices at fertility clinics. Jody Madeira is a law professor at Indiana University who's been following dozens of cases here in the U.S. and in other countries. Do you think physicians using the incorrect donor sperm or using their own should be considered sexual assault? How should the law handle these cases? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Coming up, we look at how states are dealing with fertility fraud when there is no legal framework. Stay with us. This conversation continues after this news update here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about IVF, in vitro fertilization, and fertility fraud cases here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Fertility doctors who have used their own sperm, these cases are cropping up decades later as children of artificial insemination use these at-home DNA tests, discovering that their biological father is neither the man who raised them nor the sperm donor. And some states are responding. As we've heard, Texas passed a law this summer making it a crime for a fertility doctor to inseminate a patient without her consent. Indiana, California, they have laws on the books. Jody Madeira is watching these cases unfold as a professor of law and co-director of the Center for Law, Society, and Culture at Indiana University, and she stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now. Dawn is joining us from Foxville. Hi, Dawn.
Hi. I love NPR. In fact, you guys always stimulate us in great conversations, and it's funny, we were having a conversation just this Sunday night. We have a friend that would like to have a baby, but he's a single person, single male, and he's, you know, I said, why don't you just do what women do? And he says, if you only knew, you know, the difference between men and women. So I hope you have a show on men wanting babies too and the differences. But as far as you're talking about the consequences of these doctors, I feel as though any doctor that creates a crime is to this fact that they are not allowed to serve out in the community anywhere, but they can serve their time in prisons or jails and then help the patient or prisoners and them there. I work in an ER, and it's really frustrating seeing how many prisoners come into our emergency room for care when I feel that maybe this could be taken care of through the punishment of these doctors who create these crimes. But I was also wondering, I think in France you had a show on the other day that said that you're only allowed to donate 10 times, like in France or something like that. And I'm thinking if they were limited to the amount of sperm donations people were allowed, that this would also take care of this problem.
Well, Don, let's toss it. Yeah, thank you for the call. Let's toss this back to Jody. Are there limits on the amount of donation, first of all?
Yes, there are limits if there's a known donor. So apparently it's difficult to maintain control over all the people who donate. I remember seeing a really horrifying article from England where there was an underground sperm donor who claimed to have donated 800 times, and he would meet people in rest stops alongside a highway and just exchange, you know, samples and would get testing that he thought was proper and things like that. But, you know, that is really horrifying because it raises issues of donor consanguinity. But when you get to sperm banks, usually you will have upper limits from 10 to 25 times for donors. I believe the UK has a limit of 25. Other countries have a limit of 25. A lot of these doctors, interestingly enough, not the fertility fraud perpetrators, but, you know, who procured donations from medical residents at this time, which was the way it was done, actually promised families that these doctors would donate three times and then basically be retired.
So among the cases you've looked at, Jody, is it possible that some of these doctors did not act with malintent?
I think when you look at the quality of intent, they had to have known it was not the standard of care at the time. It's very hard, very difficult to find materials where doctors are discussing this. There's a 1987 survey from the Office of Technology Assessment that surveyed all physicians, all OBGYNs, fertility physicians at the time, who had four or more cycles of insemination a year. And at that point, 2% said that they used their own sperm, but you have to wonder why the survey asked that as an option in the first place. So it must have been sort of back knowledge among some providers that this was going on, but there's no documentation of that. And it was still, I think it's come out in the cases recently, that every time a clinic is sued, they say this was not the standard of care. The doctors who have been sued in depositions state that this is not the standard of care.
Rick from Milwaukee is wondering if these physicians should be paying child support as part of the legality here.
You know, I think that's a great question, because normally what happens, and the irony is that in several states, you do have to provide donor sperm to a physician to waive paternal rights. But these physicians never terminated their parental rights. And so arguably, the doctor-conceived children do have inheritance rights, do have claims to child support. And I actually think there's a Canada case going on against a doctor named Norman Barwin, who at one time was president of the Canadian Fertility Society. Barwin's being sued by 11 doctor-conceived children and 150 individuals, largely men who claim he lost or contaminated their samples. And so the claims in that case include sort of alienation of family affections. You know, you don't grow up next to the doctor's relatives. And of course, you're deprived of, you know, support.
So as you look at these cases, and these stories seem to have common threads, as you say, it seems like it's possible it's not just an issue of the occasional sexual predator in a profession. Is it possible that among certain fertility doctors, this has been a known practice that has just gone under the radar for a very long time, and that is what is surfacing here?
It is possible. I think it was still not that common, right? So if we go back to that 1987 survey, if 2% of physicians said that they were doing this out of 267 physicians, that's roughly about 5 doctors, you know, nationwide. And so most are very careful not to do this. But I think there is great temptation to do this at certain times, too, because it must have been hard to procure the donors. It must have been hard to line everything up with different patient cycles, particularly if you were a busy doctor and many women trusted you to help them with their fertility journeys. But I don't think that excuses what the doctors did.
Oh, because you want the best outcome for your patients. You want the best outcome for your business so that more people come into your practice.
Yes, exactly. So that's a powerful incentive. And at this time, direct-to-consumer genetic testing is la-la land. No one believes that it's going to exist. And so they're like, how could I ever be found out? You know, particularly when they're expecting it to be an anonymous medical resident donor.
We're talking with Jody Madeira. She's a professor of law and co-director of the Center for Law, Society, and Culture at the Maurer School of Law at Indiana University. Still time for your thoughts here at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Going back to your state in Indiana with Dr. Donald Klein, who fathered more than 50 children using his own sperm without a patient's consent, you know, he was initially charged with 2 counts of felony obstruction of justice, as you said, before the state passed a law expressly outlawing fertility fraud. How can victims be sure that they'll get their day in court, whether they're in Indiana or anywhere in the country?
So I think there are several options. If you want a day in court, then if you allow a pretty broad definition for what counts as court, you can talk to the attorney general, you can talk to the prosecutor, you can familiarize yourself with state law, you can seek assistance from a civil attorney who practices in medical malpractice. Another area of attorneys that have been taking these cases are wills, trusts, and estates attorneys, although most are, you know, personal injury or medical malpractice. You can go to the media and you can tell the media your story. There are several options, and different, you know, families have chosen options that feel right with them, depending on their privacy, depending on the type of accountability they want. Unfortunately, you know, many have had found it necessary to pass a state law if they want their day in court, you know, particularly in the criminal sense.
Do we see any movement in other states that there will be some laws put in place around fertility fraud? Is there any movement?
Yes, I believe that there is. So this law passed unanimously in both Texas and Indiana, you know, the various types. And I believe that there is other states, you know, states largely in which cases have been brought that may revisit these. It's important to know, though, that even if you have a law like Indiana's, which is a criminal cause of action for fertility fraud and a civil cause of action, the criminal cause of action can't be used retroactively to seek punishment for these doctors who did this, you know, from the 40s to the 1980s. It just can't, because there is a principle in criminal law that says someone has to be charged under a law that is on the books at that time. So if you're going to hold those people criminally accountable, it has to be fraud or a sex assault law or something like that.
Well, let's squeeze in one more call here. Eileen in Milwaukee is with us. Hi, Eileen.
Hi. I'm just wondering, would it be possible for the doctor, any doctor, to have to take a DNA test and then with the in the consent saying that the doctor will take a DNA test and the baby can be tested afterwards in all the cases going forward?
Great question, Eileen. What do we see there, Jody?
Yes, I think that is a great question. And I think that could certainly be built in. It's very unlikely to happen these days because the sperm already has to be frozen. It has to be tested for HIV and other issues. And so more and more, the sperm comes from banks. So the chances that a doctor would use his gametes is very low. And they know, of course, that direct-to-consumer genetic testing exists because fresh sperm is no longer what most doctors use. For eggs, where many fresh eggs are used, it's unlikely a female provider would do this because she has to go through a long period of hormonal, you know, drugs and then a retrieval that she cannot perform herself. What is interesting, though, is that there are many so-called abandoned embryos out there where people can't find contact information for the couples, or the couples have said, we don't want to use the embryos. And I could see an unscrupulous provider matching the embryos up with different families seeking to get pregnant.
Well, Jody, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Jody Madeira is a professor of law, and she is co-director of the Center of Law, Society, and Culture at the Maurer School of Law at Indiana University. Her most recent book is called Taking Baby Steps, How Patients and Fertility Clinics Collaborate in Conception. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're dropping in now to learn about Wisconsin's livestock facility siting rule here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The rule creates a uniform set of standards and regulations of livestock facilities to be used by local governments for new or expanding farms. And the state ag department held 6 public hearings in recent weeks to gather comments, but some ag industry groups say the proposed changes could force some farms out of business. So have you heard about the livestock siting revisions? What questions do you have? What confuses you? Are you a farmer looking to expand? Do you have concerns? We're at 800-642-1234. Sarah Walling is administrator of the Division of Agriculture Resource Management at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So explain what our state's current livestock siting rules are.
Sure. So our current livestock facility siting rule was created in 2006, And like you said, it provides a set of standards and a process that local governments may use when they choose to regulate livestock facilities at the local level, with the goal, as you mentioned, of providing uniform local regulations for those livestock facilities when they choose to expand or site a new operation.
So what might some of those provisions look like? What might be some of those rules that these farmers have to follow in terms of livestock?
Sure. So a lot of the aspects related to livestock facility siting is, of course, as it says, is where it's sited on the landscape. And so the setbacks related to where those facilities, like manure storage structures, et cetera, need to be placed from neighboring property lines, as well as other considerations related to agricultural performance standards like the nutrient management standard, tillage setbacks, et cetera. So a lot of those are consistent among a number of our regulations in the state that oversee livestock operations.
So the rules came around in 2006, and your department has been doing some of these public comment in this public comment period over the last few months to revise the rules. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. So as you said, we've held 12 actual public hearings across the state in six separate locations during the month of September and August. And through that process, we've received over 460 comments written, as well as 161 folks that came out to provide verbal testimony at one of those hearings. The rule revision that they were coming in to give us comment about really attempts to update the 13-year-old standards in order to help be consistent with those of other agricultural regulations, modify the standards based on recommendations of three technical advisory committees that we held over the course of the last 13 years, and then improve the implementation process at the local level.
And it sounds like setback regulations are the one that people are really zooming in on as perhaps a form of, somewhat controversial. What about setback?
Sure. As you mentioned, yes, the main changes in the rule really focus on the setbacks of those livestock facility structures from neighboring property lines. But in relation to that, it really is moving us away in the 2006 version of the rule from the use of an odor score that is determined by an odor model that helps define how far from a neighbor's property line a structure like a manure storage lagoon can be placed. We're moving away from that and more into a system of distance-based setbacks that increase based on the size of the operation and the number of animals that it includes.
So does it cause confusion, though, and add work for farmers and municipalities if the state regulations are more strict than the local government regulations?
So the local government regulations are, they can always be less stringent than the state standards, but the state standards are there to, establish the ceiling for those. So local units of government at this point are not allowed to be more restrictive than what the state guidelines would lay out for them. So while I do not anticipate this will actually cause more work, it certainly sets in place a little bit more predictability, in our opinion, for the placement of expansions or siting certainly of new livestock facilities, because the odor model really it was a bit of a moving target. This provides a little bit more predictability because the standards and the setbacks are really set in place through this rule. So there's a lot less confusion about what the requirements would be when a livestock facility chooses to expand and is trying to locate a new or expanding manure storage pit on their facility, for instance.
Oh, because like odor can be subjective. One person can smell something, another person can't, or that odor can change due to the wind.
Absolutely. And there is the ability for those setbacks to be reduced if the farm chooses to include any odor mitigation practices that could that have been determined scientifically to reduce the amount of odor generated from those facilities. So that setback can decrease if they choose to go that route.
We're talking about Wisconsin's livestock facility siting rule, proposed changes on the horizon with Sarah Walling. She's administrator of the Division of Agriculture Resource Management at the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Your questions, your concerns, welcome, 800-642-1234. So we've heard 11 groups throughout the state, Sarah, including the Dairy Business Association, the Wisconsin Farm Bureau, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. They all signed a joint statement in opposition to these revisions. What is your response to their concerns?
Well, it's difficult for us to predict all the impacts that these rule revisions could have. And we certainly understand that in particular the proposed setbacks may have some impacts in some communities and on the ability of certain farms to be able to expand in place or potentially site new operations. But it's also extremely important to note that currently permitted farms or farms that are located in places that choose not to adopt livestock facility siting at the local level would not be subject to these new standards. They're certainly not subject retroactively, and the changes would only impact a farm if it ever chooses to significantly expand in the number of animal units or site a new operation in a place that has chosen to adopt livestock facility siting at the local level through an ordinance.
So as you, had this public comment period and, you received hundreds of written comments, what concerns did you hear from farmers? What were some of the common threats?
Sure. Well, as you said, we've received a lot of comments. And one of the things that we take very seriously at the department is our public hearing process. And so we will comb through each and every one of those comments and digest them as we make considerations to move forward with a final draft. Of course, the concerns are from farmers that are concerned that they have plans to expand, in some cases large expansions, in some cases fairly moderate. And so they're concerned about how these setbacks would impact their ability to add more animals to their operations as they grow and add their family members into those operations over time. And we're certainly listening to each of those, but we're also listening to the rest of the comments that we've received as well from neighbors of these livestock facilities in some cases that have been there 20, 30 years and are concerned and frustrated with the level of odor and other nuisances related to some of the operations.
So what happens next for these rule changes? Where does it go from here?
Well, again, we're in the process of reviewing all of those comments and taking them into consideration as we draft a final proposal that we would like to take to our board in November. We will be taking an overview of the comments that we've received to our DATCAP board on Thursday, just to give them an overview of what we've been hearing. Should they choose to approve our rule in November, it would move on to the governor and then ultimately the legislature for the process to continue where it hits the House's ag committees and then the other components of the rulemaking process at the legislative level.
Well, Sarah, we only have a few seconds left, but some ag groups, business groups are concerned this will hamper livestock growth in Wisconsin. Do you see a possibility?
Well, it's difficult for us to say. The expansions have continued over time, certainly, as our agricultural industry has evolved over the last 13 years, and this rule is really attempting to just step up and be able to accommodate the types of changes in our agricultural operations that we are experiencing today. I certainly hope that this rule does not discourage livestock farming. Certainly our intention is just the opposite, and it's instead to provide some consistent regulations that local governments can use when they're making siting decisions.
Sarah, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Sarah Walling is administrator of the Division of Agricultural Resource Management at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. And just after 4 on Central Time, you can hear another perspective about these proposed changes. Rob Ferret talks with a representative from the Wisconsin Dairy Farmers about why they feel this could hurt the state's egg industry. That is after 4 on Central Time. Just ahead, spices. There's so many of them. How do we decide which ones to use? We'll talk about it. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.